You are listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, July 5th, 2015, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I begin this morning's meditation by recalling Rod Suderman's opening remarks last Sunday. If it were not for the lectionary, there's no way I would have chosen today's reading. This is a passage I've managed to ignore all my life, and the few times I have looked at it, I've wondered why in the world it's in the Bible. 2 Corinthians is one of the more difficult letters to understand. Paul's second visit to Corinth seems to have been an absolute disaster. It was filled with tension, with personality conflicts, infighting. Paul did not get along with any of the deacons in the church or other ministers in the church, and he says some pretty straight things about them. His letter, which is now known as 2 Corinthians, seems to be a collection of writings, not a unified letter. Maybe it's something he wrote while he was on this ship or that. He was thinking about the church at Corinth time and again, trying to figure out in his own mind, dare I go back and visit them again? Will they just kick me out? What will the reception be? Would it be of any use to even go back to a church I planted? His letter is filled with appeals, rebukes, attacks, counterattacks, and, in today's passage, self-praise and irony. The whole tone of the final three chapters of 2 Corinthians is disheartening reading. We're listening to someone who is unable to let go of his former status. Paul is in denial. People no longer agree with him as they used to. Paul felt that his view of the church was losing out, and that young people were no longer looking to him for answers. New, younger preachers were appearing, and their teachings were remarkably different than his. As these new teachers attempted to establish their credentials in Corinth, they told people what made them particularly qualified. So, Paul gives some of his stories of qualification. They had theirs, he has his. In the two previous chapters, Paul makes some pretty strong statements. In chapter 10, verse 18, he says, "For it is not those who commend themselves that are approved, but those who the Lord commends." True enough. But to the disinterested reader, both Paul and his rivals are commending themselves. Chapter 11, verse 5 really gets me. "I think that I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles." I cringe at that kind of statement. It'd be like a teacher saying, "Well, I never got a teaching award, but I'm just as good a teacher as they are." And that's not a conversation starter. You know? That means you have to go and talk to someone else. Well, let's look at our passage today. Chapter 12 in 2 Corinthians says, well, we heard a dramatic reading of chapter 11, shipwrecks and all of that. He was pointing out all the problems. And now in chapter 12, he says, okay, I've established my credentials as a suffering servant. Now, let's talk about my spiritual credentials. Verse 2. "I know of a person in Christ who, 14 years ago, was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows." Most people assume that Paul is writing about himself in the third person, and I find this the simplest way to approach the passage. Otherwise, I'm not sure what to do with it. So I'm going to assume that Paul is talking about himself. He certainly talked about himself in the last chapter, and he's going to talk about himself in the next chapter. The background for this kind of illustration, being caught up into heaven, seems to be that some Christians wanted a new spiritual experience. Maybe a vision, maybe an out-of-body experience. The rush of the conversion wears off. What are you going to do to regain that initial glow? Well, I think being caught up into the third heaven might be a good way to get some of that glow back again. Now, as for the third heaven, their cosmology was very geographically oriented. So the first heaven is sort of the world and its atmosphere. The second heaven are the stars, planets, sun, and moon. The third heaven is geographically beyond that in their way of thinking, and that's where God is. So Paul is thinking geographically about heaven the way they did. Not the way I think, but that's the way their view was at that time. The whole universe sort of revolves around the earth. Other books, like the second book of Enoch, refer to seven heavens, from which we get the thought she was in seventh heaven when such and such happened. In one Jewish contemporary book with Jesus, decided there were 390 heavens. So, take your pick. But behind this whole talk about a human going to heaven and back, round trip ticket, is this question: are there such things as super Christians or super people who get these super experiences? If someone has this kind of out-of-body experience, does that mean their faith is superior to mine, or that they are more qualified to be a preacher than I am? Well, anybody is, but Paul's asking that. Verse 4, I was caught up into paradise and heard things that are not to be told, that no mortal is permitted to repeat. Paul is saying, although he heard things when he was up in third heaven, he could talk about them as a way of upstaging his rivals at Corinth, but he's decided he's not going to do that. So instead of scoring those points, he remains silent on the juicy details of that experience. But I notice the way he says it, he's having it both ways. Yeah, we see through him. Verse 6. Let's see. But if I wish to boast, I will not be a fool, for I am speaking the truth. But I refrain from boasting, so that no one may think better of me than what is seen in me and heard from me. I like this verse. It says basically, what you see is what you get. Examine my life, examine my words, not what I say about my visions or my out-of-body experience or my first-class trip to heaven and back. Verse 7 continues this thought, even considering the exceptional character of the revelations. He's being very clever here. The tantalizing statement that says, boy, were my revelations good or what? But I'm not going to talk about them. No, that would be boasting. And then we come to the best known phrase in the whole book of 2 Corinthians, thorn in the flesh. And people have had a great deal of enjoyment, I guess, trying to figure out what this thorn in the flesh was. Everything imaginable: lingering illness, bad back, migraines, a speech impediment, because he's apparently a bad public speaker and a very bad debater. Rheumatism, ongoing depression, people not accepting his points of view, and my favorite, a bad marriage. We don't know. It's just all over the place, the thorn in the flesh. But it's entered our language vocabulary. Verse 8, three times I appealed to the Lord about this thorn in the flesh, that it would leave me. Three times is all. You know, you could pray that often in 30 minutes. So I'm not sure how serious this thorn in the flesh was. Verse 9, but the Lord said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness. So I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Ancient Corinth was filled with images of power. The Temple of Apollo was one of its biggest buildings, proclaiming the supremacy and power of that god. The Corinthian trade centers and trade routes portrayed its economic power. Its stadia proclaimed the power of Corinth as even a center for athletes to meet throughout the Hellenic world every other year for contests. The culture of displaying power shaped the thinking of the city's new Christian converts. These citizens in a city of power naturally looked for individuals with authority and power. In this context at Corinth, some new preachers used stories of their visions, and possibly even stories about undergoing rapture itself, in order to gain credence and obtain power of position, power of authority. And if it's at Paul's expense, that's the way it goes. Corinth was about power, intellectual power, economic power, military power. Corinth was not about the cross. The cross was the lowest possible public disgrace. The cross was the symbol of a total loss of personal power. The cross symbolized the power your opponent had over you as you're on the cross, unable to move. You are powerless. The cross symbolized the powerlessness of Christ. Corinth was about power. Another striking idea in this passage is weakness. Paul, I think, is using a clever rhetorical device. He argues the opposite of what people expect him. He does not claim personal strength or special ability, or tries to upstage other preachers with details of his visions or his trips to third heaven, although I'm bothered that he even alludes to them. Instead, he says, I have weaknesses. And then he puts those forward as being the way in which God's strength can be shown best. I wish Paul had enumerated his weaknesses. I really wish, I don't consider being in a shipwreck a weakness. That's just bad travel agency or whatever. Being flogged is not a weakness. That's a consequence. So I don't know what his weaknesses really were. I want to speak a little bit about curriculum vitae. Curriculum vitae, the turning of life, or the course that life takes. Every time I've applied for a job, I had to supply some sort of CV. In a sense, 2 Corinthians 12 is a loose comparison of CVs. Paul's CVs and the CVs of his rivals. Who has the best credentials for the job? In fact, your CV is supposed to clarify precisely why you are qualified for the job. Maybe even the best qualified person, if you know how to twist your CV in the right way. Very best person available for that job. Paul knows this is the case, and so his putting forward his own CV in 2 Corinthians. But I'm intrigued that Paul also wants to change the criteria for how we evaluate candidates seeking to lead churches. He's saying, look past the obvious strengths of a candidate, look past their special spiritual experiences, and instead, ask, is the candidate aware of weaknesses? It's not the way we usually approach CVs. In the context of our small fellowship, I've decided to rephrase what Paul is saying. We do not hire a minister, so we never ask people, can we see your CV before we invite them to speak? Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. We could have several people, as in Corinth, vie with each other for unofficial power and authority in our little fellowship. And these people would then find subtle ways, like Paul, to put their CVs forward. Or, and I know a church like that in France, and that church is having real trouble, Mennonite church, and in fact the church is falling apart because of the conflicts of personalities, as they feel they're the ones who are qualified and no one else. Or we could try to be open to encouraging many people, everyone who is interested to contributing to the fellowship, to do so with no single person bearing responsibility for spiritual guidance, for visitation, for hymn singing, or whatever. In fact, I come to this fellowship because of its openness, its eagerness to have many people do all sorts of things. And we have a lack of vying with each other about my vision is better than yours. We likely fall short of the ideal, but we try. I think in our fellowship we tend to look at things a little differently than Paul. We think to ourselves, is my friend here, who is sitting beside me in this fellowship, someone who is willing to help me? Or is it somebody who wants to get ahead of others in this fellowship? Is my friend in this fellowship, who I'm sitting beside, focused mainly on his or her ideas, or what she has learned in life, or learned from dreams, or reading, or whatever? Or is the person willing to give a contribution, but then also listen equally to what other people have to say? Does someone seem to think they're full of God's Spirit, or are they just mostly full of themselves? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. Well, what should be on my list of weaknesses? Time does not permit. What should be on your list of weaknesses? How might I become powerful through my weaknesses? How might God become powerful through your weaknesses? How can God's Spirit become evident through the weaknesses of our fellowship? These are questions I cannot answer. That is my weakness. It is also my strength. Make me a captive, Lord, and then I shall be free. Force me to render up my sword, and I shall conqueror be. I sink in life's alarms when by myself I stand. Imprison me within thine arms, and strong shall be my hand.